See, Mike, can I get you to pass these out for me, please? Well, today we're going to be discussing the sixth era, or the Philadelphia era, of both the Old and New Testaments. The last time we left off at the end of the Sardis era, in the Old Testament we were in about the year 333 B.C., where Alexander the Great defeated the great Persian king Darius III at the Battle of Issus, and then took over the rest of the Middle East over the next few years. He came down through the south. As you know, he attacked across the Bosporus, then attacked down to the south and took what is Tyre in about a year and a half long siege. And of course, we all studied that years ago, how he built a causeway out to it. Alexander the Great did. And then after that, he came down to the area that was called Judah. The Latins, or the Romans, called it Judea, Latinized it. It was never called Palestine until the British called it that in the early 1900s. So we call the land of Palestine. That's a very new modern term. Nobody ever fought over Palestine until the last century. But the land, of course, has been called a number of things, but we'll simply call it the land of Palestine, or the land of Judah or Judea. Now, one thing we've seen, if we do a little bit of review, at the end of each one of the eras, we know that the signal that the new era has begun, or the old era is over, is that the leadership of the church becomes corrupt. It happened at the end of the time of Joshua, where everyone did what was right in their own eyes. There was no king in Israel, and in fact there was no single God being worshipped in Israel. So God allowed Saul to become king. Then Solomon became somewhat corrupt, but his son Jeroboam was completely corrupt, or Rehoboam, I mean. And so at that time, the split became the divided kingdom, and that lasted until the fall of Jerusalem under Zedekiah, and of course earlier than that, the fall of Samaria, when they were the northern ten tribes of Israel. But in each case, the key that the era was coming to an end was that the leadership became corrupt and God no longer would deal with them. Then we have the church coming out of the captivity, which we dealt with last time, and talked about how after the time of Nehemiah, Nehemiah made at least two trips back from Babylon, and of course Ezra was also there, but before that Joshua and Zerubbabel had come back, and the people who had landed back in Jerusalem simply would not hold fast to the truth and worship God the right way. They continually went back to the idolatry of the land around them, and eventually their priesthood became corrupt, and it would be time then for them to be replaced. Let me read to you from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia what happened in the years from about 320 until about the years 200. A very sketchy time of history in some ways. And of course, what was going on in Jerusalem was simply that they were a vassal state of the southern kingdom of Ptolemies. As you recall, when Alexander the Great took over the world, essentially the known world, 10 years later he died. He died on June the 13th, 323. He died in Babylon, in the throne room of the ancient king of Babylon. He had four generals, and they've divided his kingdom up in four different pieces. The two that become very important are the Ptolemies, who ruled in Egypt, and the Seleucidae, or the Seleucids, who became king in Syria and to the area we call Turkey or Asia Minor, because they became then the king of the north and the king of the south. And for the next 200 years, Jerusalem and the land of Palestine was like a rope in a tug-of-war as these northern and southern kingdoms contested over control of that area. Of course, it's very easily written out for us in the book of Daniel. I want to begin today over in Daniel. If you turn with me over Daniel chapter 11. Some believe that the history of the sixth era of the church in the Old Testament is not written about in the Bible, that we simply have to look at Josephus, also the Apocrypha, and other historical sources to find out what happened. That's not necessarily the case. In Daniel chapter 11, in this fabulous prophecy, we do have a description of what would happen to these people and what they would do during the time after Nehemiah left Jerusalem, either left, went back to Babylon, or died. But in this era of the church, in this sixth era, we have this summary beginning in verse 30 of Daniel chapter 11. It is a prophecy given several hundred years in advance. Daniel lived, as you know, in the 500s B.C. This written probably will be about 570 B.C., maybe 560. and it didn't occur until the 300s, so easily 300 years, 250 before it occurred. Verse 30, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Now this is way into the future. If you've studied this chapter like most of us have, you know this is Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the IV, who came from Syria down through the Middle East, down through Palestine, and was going to attack the city of Alexandria, where the Ptolemies had their headquarters, and where they built that massive library. What happened was the Romans, the Ptolemies appealed for help from Rome, and the Romans sent a fleet of ships full of troops. And when Antiochus heard about this fleet of ships coming, he realized he was going to be defeated, so he turned back and went to the north. And on the way back, he ordered his general, Apollonius, I believe it was, to sack Jerusalem and destroy it and to begin doing a lot of other evil things because he was upset and didn't want to go home a loser, wanted to go home a victor. So ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. He shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. In other words, he would focus on those people that still have the Holy Covenant with God. So it would be against the Jews who were living there and trying to worship God. Forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, and they shall take away the daily sacrifices or the daily worship of God. The word sacrifices there means ongoing worship of God, and place the abomination of desolation. Now later in Matthew 24, Jesus Christ said, this is something you need to understand. We need to understand the abomination of desolation. So our study of the sixth era of the church is directly obeying what Jesus Christ said to do. Because probably none of us could get up here and give a very quick summary, accurately, historically, of what went on with the abomination of desolation. I'm sure we've all studied it, but you know we all have Alzheimer's, so just a matter of reviewing it. Those who do wickedly against the covenant shall corrupt with flattery. So there would be some people who were covenant people with God who would be corrupted by flattery and would join with their enemy, would join with this Antiochus individual. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. So in advance, 250, 60 years in advance, God predicted through Daniel, through this angel that came to him, that the people of God, some would be corrupted by flattery by this Greek king, Antiochus, but others who knew God would do great exploits and would carry out with great strength. Those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame. So it will be a long war they would have to go through. They shall fall by sword and by flame and by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them to intrigue, or with intrigue, by intrigue. Some of those of understanding shall fall. So during that time, some of those who were true servants of God would fall. I think that we're getting to the time now in this prophecy where it is dual, not only the time of Antiochus in the 160s BC, but also in the end time. So it would be physical and spiritual because many of the army of the real God did die, physically speaking. To refine them, purify them, make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. So here we have in verse 35 a transition verse that shows us that much of what is in this chapter applies to not only the time of Antiochus, but also the time of the end. And then in verse 36, the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. And we know that that obviously refers to the beast at the end time. And of course, later we talk about verse 40, the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. And so we have this prophecy in Daniel chapter 11, a summary of what was to occur several hundred years later in what we know as the Maccabean period, but it is the time of the sixth era, or the sixth obvious different time period of the Old Testament church. Let me continue in the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, just let you know what happened during this time. Onias was high priest from 320 to 290 BC. His son Simon is often identified as Simon the Just, but the Simon in, mentions here, Sirach is one of the apocryphal books, and the confusion of later events suggests in Josephus' accounts that perhaps he was Simon the Second. During this time, repairs to the temple were made, they were strengthened in fortifications, other details, of course, carried out, until Jerusalem was taken by Antiochus III in 198 BC. Now, you notice on your handout paper that there's an important date of 198 BC. Between 332 and 198, the Ptolemies in the south, the Egyptian king, ruled over the area of Jerusalem and Judah. And he allowed them a great deal of religious freedom. They could carry on their worship at the temple. They could do all the things they knew they were supposed to do as long as they paid tribute. But in 198, this Seleucid king, who was called Antiochus III, took an army and came down and occupied the area of Jerusalem and Judah. And so he then was a very different king. Jerusalem now became, and Judah became, annexed to the north, not to the south. The highly complex and confused accounts of the struggles between the houses of Onias and Tobias, the pro-Egyptian and pro-Syrian parties, and a big tree to join positions lie beyond this article. Essentially what he's saying is that the two families of the high priests began to be very politically oriented. Some were aligned with the Egyptians, some with the Syrians, and some were trying to play the middle. So we have this religious group who were leading the group at that time, the country, who became corrupt through political intrigue. This is here, alongside the struggle in Judah was the constant struggle between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. This ended in 198 when the Seleucid Antiochus III took over all of Coele-Syria, which means Greater Syria. Together means Syria and Palestine. The Hellenizers, those who wanted to force people to worship Hellas or Helen, the god of the Greeks, were thus given more authority. Antiochus IV Epiphanes came to the throne in 175 BC, succeeded his elder brother Seleucus Philopater, and at once set in motion to Hellenize, civilize was his term, the entire realm. Greek altars were set up at many places, and the worship of Greek gods was required. He made Jason, who had Hellenized his name from Joshua, high priest, on Jason's promise that he would vigorously pursue a program of Hellenization. So Antiochus was able to get the leader of the priesthood at that time to go in league with him and agree to begin to force Hellenization on all the people of Judah. He mentions later that the image of Jupiter was set up on the altar, the desolating sacrilege of Matthew 24. The courts of the temple were filled with Greek soldiers, hero duels, and the performance of licentious pagan rites. The sacred scriptures were defiled or destroyed. Now, to read out of there would be a little bit of a cumbersome thing. So what I found, we have two sources. The best source of history during this time period is Josephus, and also the books called the Apocrypha. The first book of Maccabees covers much of this, and second Maccabees also. The Apocrypha is not evil books. They're simply Jewish historical books. And, of course, the Catholics inserted them into the Vulgate just to show they were in authority over the scriptures, but doesn't make the books themselves of any less value. They are very good historical books, and much of what we'll read today is contained in the book of 1st and 2nd Maccabees, but that would be about 100 pages long. I don't think we have time for that. So I have a book here called Battles of the Bible by Chaim Herzog and Mordecai Gihon. Both of them were associates of Benjamin Mazar at the University of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and have written an excellent book. They cover some of this in detail, and I believe it would be in our best interest to read this account because it will take us a lot less time. I think it's very understandable. The battles of the Maccabees brought forth one of the great captains of history, Judah the Maccabee. The word Maccabee means hammer or hammerer. They were the first battles in recorded history fought over the issue of religious freedom. What distinguishes them is the military genius of Judah the Maccabee, who departed radically from the tactics universally applied at the time and instinctively adapted the principles of war in an entirely novel manner. The Maccabean revolt opened in 167 BC after an extended period in which no organized Jewish force had engaged in warfare. Indeed, the last battle in which a major Jewish force had taken up arms had been in 586 BC, over 400 years earlier, when the Jewish defenders of Jerusalem fought a losing battle against the invading forces of Nebuchadnezzar. In the middle of the 2nd century BC, Judea was a small province of the Syrian-based Seleucid Empire. It had been so since the Seleucid monarch Antiochus III wrested the area of Palestine from the Ptolemies of Egypt and incorporated Judea into his empire in 198 BC. In the days of Judah the Maccabee, the province was a rectangular-shaped area covering about 1,000 square miles, each side of the rectangle measuring some 30 to 40 miles. The area itself was mountainous, broken by villages or wadis running down to the Mediterranean Sea in the west or the Jordan Valley in the east. The population was about 250,000. In 332 BC, Alexander the Great of Macedonia, one of the greatest generals in all history, defeated the Persians and took control of the Persian Empire. That extended deep into Asia, including Judah, which has been Latinized as Judea. On his untimely death in 323 BC, the lands he conquered from Egypt and Asia Minor in the west to India were divided among his four Macedonian generals, and they, of course, fought over the inheritance. Ptolemy was assigned to the satrapy of Egypt. He soon established himself as a king based in Alexandria. Seleucus, who had been apportioned the satrapy of Babylon, likewise crowned himself king with his capital in Seleucia. He later extended his area to Syria and made his new capital in Antioch. The long-standing rivalry between the ruling power in Syria and that in Egypt manifested itself once more. In 198 B.C., Antiochus III, the father of the emperor against whom the Maccabees were to revolt, took Palestine from the Ptolemies, making it a part of the Seleucid Empire. The Jews had enjoyed a fairly benevolent rule under the Ptolemies. Apart from the requirement of a heavy annual tribute, Judea was in effect an autonomous region. The first century AD historian Flavius Josephus describes how the Jews were free to administer their own affairs in peace, to practice their religion without molestation, and to conduct the traditional Jewish rites at their temple in Jerusalem. This policy of tolerance towards the practice of Jewish religion and respect for the domestic autonomy of the Jews in Judea was maintained by the Seleucids under Antiochus III. But it changed in 175 when Antiochus IV came to power. He realized that while he would undoubtedly find himself in conflict with his southern neighbor, Egypt, the main threat might come from the growing power of Rome. Judea did not pose a military threat. However, the danger threatening him in the Medes and the Parthians posed a constant threat, so he resolved to secure the vital strategic province by imposing Greek culture rites on his population. What he wanted to do was simply establish a single religion throughout his empire. The instrument for unity would be Hellenism, and this process would be carried out not only for religious and social ends, but for political purposes. So the enforcing of one religion on the entire area was set here as an example. The process of Hellenizing Judea, and especially Jerusalem, the Seleucids' assumption of the authority to appoint a high priest who was the spiritual leader of the Jews, and the split between the Hellenized Jews and those who remained true to their traditions and faith, caused a rebellion to break out in Jerusalem. News of this uprising reached Antiochus in 168 BC as he was withdrawing northwards along the coastal road from Egypt after abandoning the siege of Alexandria. The withdrawal had been a humiliating move as he left under the threat of Roman intervention. It was therefore in a mood of anger he dispatched forces under one of his generals, Apollonius, I guess it would be, to Judea. The Seleucid troops engaged in a massacre of the Jewish population in Jerusalem. They burned and pillaged and broke the temple, stealing many of the precious holy vessels. Thereafter, the temple was converted into a Hellenist shrine dedicated to the Olympian Zeus, and the sacrificial offering of a pig crowned this profane act of desecration. A fortress known as Acra, or the Citadel, was constructed on a hill facing the temple commanding it, and a permanent garrison surrounded there. Steps were taken to impose the will of Antiochus on the rebellious Jews and eradicate the influence of Jewish rites and customs. Jews were forbidden on penalty of death to congregate in prayer, to observe the Sabbath and religious festivals, to carry out circumcision, or to adhere to dietary laws. They were obliged to participate in pagan rituals, including sacrificing pigs and partaking of their flesh. After subduing Jerusalem, Antiochus pursued his goal of de-Judaizing Judea by moving into the countryside with troops under orders to enforce the regulations against Jewish practices. One of these units, under an officer named Apelles, arrived in the village of Modin in the foothills of Judea, northwest of Jerusalem. An altar was set up in the village, and before the assembled population, Mattathias, a Jewish priest, was ordered to perform a sacrifice and eat of the pig's flesh. With him were his five sons. When Mattathias did not move from his spot, one of the assembled Jews moved forward to the altar to obey the order and perform the sacrifice. Mattathias rushed forward in fury, slew the traitor, and killed Apelles. His sons led the villagers against the Greek unit, wiping it out. Thus began the revolt of the Maccabees. Mattathias led the people of his village into the hills of Gophna, a section of the Judean hills immediately northwest of present-day Gamla. They numbered about 200, of whom probably not more than 50 were able-bodied men, and they lacked any military training whatsoever. For approximately a year, the rebels made preparations in relative peace. They trained in guerrilla warfare and recruited new members to their ranks. emphasis was laid on the reaffirmation of the principles of Judaism for which they were fighting. They defended themselves whenever necessary, but initiated a few operations while organizing their base. Soon, though, they had additional help. An effective intelligence gathering organization was developed as People's Militia grew under the leadership of Judah the Maccabee. Matthias had designated Judah, his middle son, to succeed him before the aged priest died in the first year of the revolt. Armed with farm implements and a primitive nature of homemade weapons, such as the mason sling, Judah's small group prepared to give battle to an up-to-date Greek army. Their ranks were composed of heavy and light infantry, heavy and light cavalry, chariots, elephants from India, and artillery units operating ballistas, which were engines for hurling huge stones. Their weapons included swords, javelins, spears, bows, slings, ballistas, and battering rams. Judah analyzed the seemingly hopeless situation and instinctively enumerated the elements that could be put to work in his favor. Though the Seleucid troops enjoy overwhelming superiority in manpower and arms, they were trained only for set-piece battle in conventional fighting form. They were also mercenaries with little or no commitment to a cause. Facing them would be the sons of the country fighting on their own soil and for their own people, prepared to die for their religious beliefs and freedom. Since they were trained to fight by day, the Jewish military must strike by night. Furthermore, Judah's forces, small as they were, enjoyed one of the basic requirements of guerrilla force. As they proceeded with their training and gained confidence, Judah's guerrillas developed and strengthened their supply lines to the villages scattered over by the countryside. Seleucid sent an army against them. Apollonius, the governor, commander of the Antiochus forces in the region, was based in Samaria, decided to intervene. The core of the Seleucid army was the phalanx. A tactical formation consisted of heavy infantry drawn up in close order. The weakness of this organization was the fact that it was cumbersome and precluded the element of surprise. As a result, one of the main tactics of war was absent in this type of planning. Now we have the first of four very important battles in history. I listed them for you on the sheet here. They begin in the year 165, the battles of Beth Horon, the battle at Emmaus, Beth Zur, and finally at Jerusalem. And there's a couple of more that come after that. The first battle of Beth Horon. In 166 B.C., Apollonius' force moved along the mountains, the watershed from Samaria southwards towards Jerusalem. He took the direct Samaria-Jerusalem route, which passes along the flank of the Gophna area. Apollonius advanced into Judea with a force numbering 2,000 men, while facing them was a Jewish force under Judah of approximately 600. As Judah analyzed the problem facing him, he resolved to take advantage of the element of surprise. The Seleucids' advantage would be on open, flat ground. Judah therefore decided to attack in a defile or in a valley. A large force assumed the normal preparation for set-piece battle, but Judah would attack them on the march. They were neither prepared for battle nor able to assume the positions in which they had been trained to fight. The site Judah chose for the engagement was Nahal el Haramaya, some 4 miles northeast of Gophna. At this point, the route southwards from Samaria enters a narrow defile that winds uphill for more than a mile. The enemy was approaching in columns of four. Judah decided to block the march and then push the Seleucid troops into a situation that would force them to create a front on one of their flanks. This would place the enemy in a position for which he was least prepared and which he would be the most vulnerable. Judah divided his forces into four units. One was to act as a sealing unit at the southern end of the defile. The second unit would be the main attacking force along the eastern side of the defile, towards which the main enemy would be compelled to turn. A third unit would attack from the western side, and the fourth be held at a short distance, ready to close the gap and complete the trap. It was late afternoon when the Seleucid forces came marching into the defile in columns of four. The Seleucids marched in two separate groups of approximately 1,000 men each, the commander Apollonius riding in between them. The forces advanced tightly in a bunched-up compact group, and the men behind actually bumping into the men in the front. At the signal, the sealing unit at the southern end of the defile fell upon the leading troops at the Seleucid column. The main body, unaware of what was happening at the head of the column, pressed forward. At this point, the unit on the eastern slope appeared and attacked the column from its flank. Encumbered by heavy weapons, which were unsuitable for fighting in the narrow defile, the Seleucid column turned to meet its new onslaught while the rear element of this column continued to press into the defile. At this point, the forces on the western slopes emerged and attacked from the rear. The Seleucids were now trapped and under devastating fire from both east and west. Apollonius eventually was killed. The Seleucid troops were completely trapped, and virtually all of them were annihilated. After the defeat of Apollonius' troops, Antiochus realized that he faced a serious situation in Judea. No tactical conclusions were drawn from the battle, but it was clear the emperor could not allow groups of rebels to flout his authority. Also, we find here that Judah was able to get a lot of weapons and a lot of swords and things he needed to continue on. So the Battle of Beth Horon was the first important battle in the history of the Maccabees. 600 fighters from Judah, ill-equipped, ill-trained, defeated an army 2,000 strong with the best troops and equipment that the Syrians could provide. The next battle was the Battle of Emos. Actually, a battle at Emos. It's a place where there was a large camp. And Judah once again was facing a huge force, numbered at least 27,000, that were sent down from the north to attack him and his group. This time, the Seleucid general Seron rode at the head of his troops. For Judah, the elimination of the enemy commander early in the battle was the primary mission because of the effect it would have on the morale of the enemy soldiers. This time, Judah could not hope to trap the entire enemy force as he'd done with Apollonius' troops. It says, Seron's forces set out at dawn on what was to be their last day's march before reaching Jerusalem. The front stigmata, or the first men, began the long winding ascent into the hills towards Beth Horon. It was a slow advance, as the troops were weighted down by their equipment and heavy weapons. Judah's lookouts, hidden among the rocks and the olive tree-covered hillsides, watched silently as the Seleucid forces advanced slowly up the ascent of the Beth Horon Pass. This time, Judah, wielding the sword he had taken from Apollonius, led the sealing unit. As the Seleucid vanguard approached the ambush, Judah's men charged the enemy forces. They cut down the leading Seleucid ranks, which had been immobilized by the surprise, and made for Seron. Eventually, they killed Seron and over 800 of his men. He now destroyed the two Seleucid armies by causing heavy losses in equipment. Finally, they lost over 6,000 of the enemy soldiers. He made full use of the principle of surprise and morale. He had dictated the battlefield and struck the enemy command first. He now stood at the head of a well-trained force, bolstered by victory and strengthened by combat experience. The camp at Emos was located in the foothills just above the valley of Ajalon and was sited in such a way as to ensure the topographical conditions for battle required by the Seleucid forces. Judah had taken advantage of his victory at Beth Horon to prepare his men for this new expedition. I can read all the details, but basically what Judah the Maccabee did here was he faked that he was still in his camp. The enemy had an idea to go around at night and encircle his camp, so he left all these campfires burning, pretending to be still in camp, everybody asleep. And then his men were up in the foothills. He put a few hundred men up in the foothills so that when the enemy attacked the camp and there was nobody there, they then ran up into the foothills after these stragglers they thought they had surprised. In the meantime, the main force of Judas Maccabee's troops attacked the camp at Emos and destroyed it and several thousand men. It's almost similar to the attack on Gideon Ashkelon back in the book of Judges. You might look on that a little bit farther here. Gorgias was one of the generals in the battle. He decided to imitate the tactics Judah had used earlier. He assumed that Judah would not expect a Seleucid attack at night, as the Seleucids were not accustomed to night fighting. Gorgias moved up into the hills at the head of 5,000 infantry and 1,000 cavalry troops. Judah was obviously well informed of these plans when he prepared his counterattack. He decided to employ a ruse to draw Gorgias' contingent deeper into the hills of Judah, away from the main body of the Seleucid force. He ordered large bonfires to be lit in the Jewish camp, indicating the existence of a large concentration of troops there. But under cover of darkness, he withdrew his forces from the camp, leaving it occupied by a small rear guard of about 200 men. Meanwhile, 15,000 infantry and 3,000 cavalry had been left at the enemy camp at Emos. Judah now prepared to attack this camp and take it by surprise. He sent one group of 1,500 men to wait in an area north of the Seleucid camp and move into action. Leading 3,000 men, he moved against the enemy camp at dawn and found to his surprise that the enemy forces had been alerted. They were forming up for battle in the phalanx on the plain before the camp. He could no longer attack the camp as planned. So he ended up drawing the phalanx group away, attacking it from the sides. The phalanx group broke and fell towards the camp. The other soldiers of Judas had attacked the flanks and then later attacked the camp. Nicanor's forces broke and fled towards the coast. Some 3,000 of them were killed. At this point, Judah again proved himself to be an outstanding commander, controlling all the battle at all times. He stopped the pursuit and issued orders forbidding the taking of booty. Judah knew that he had yet to contend with Gorgias. Gorgias soon received reports his camp was afire He turned back his forces, which were being harried by the light Jewish forces in the hills. The hot defeat of Amos constituted the serious blow to Antiochus, and indeed prejudiced his entire campaign in the eastern provinces. So these first two battles were just incredible in the sense that this small ragtag group of Jewish farmers was able to, with a few swords and not much training, defeat this powerful Greek army. To begin with, an army of 2,000, later battle 6,000, and finally over 20,000. So then we have, of course, the Battle of Beth Zur, which is the next battle. Each time, Antiochus sends larger armies down to defeat Judas Maccabee and his soldiers, or and his farmers, and each time they go home either whipped or don't go home at all because they're all killed. The Seleucids were not long in preparing to avenge the defeat. Lysias himself set out from Antioch at the head of a force determined once and for all to put an end to the situation in which the Maccabees had defeated one defeat after another on the mighty Seleucid armies. This time, Lysias made for Jerusalem in order to join up with the garrison at Acre. He marched his army in the traditional route along the coastal plain. He did not enter the hills of Judea along the routes taken previously by the Seleucids. The last section he passed through the land of the Idumeans, who were hostile to the Jews and friendly to their Hellenist rulers. Lysias' army has been estimated in the region of 20,000 infantry and 4,000 cavalry troops, approximately the same force that Judah had engaged at Amos. Facing Lysias at Beth Zur was a Judean force of about 10,000 men. A direct assault on Lysias' force was fraught with great danger, and of course he sought a sector whose topographical features would help him. Judah divided his forces into four groupings, the first consisting of 3,000 men, the second and third of 1,000 men each, and the fourth of 5,000 men. The Seleucid forces moved northwards on a column march. They entered along the defile. As they emerged from it, Judah's first force issued forth in the ravine where it lay in ambush and launched a surprise attack. The Seleucid lead unit was severely mauled by the sudden heavy assault, and the leading phalanx was thrown into confusion as Judah's first formation spread out and engaged the enemy follow-up units from both sides of the gully. Now the second and third groups of Judah's forces began their advance, moving forward along a front approximately a half mile wide. The unit lead of the Seleucid phalanx were beaten back. Panic spread among the following phalanxes when they discovered they were trapped in the gully with Judah's forces arrayed on the slopes of both sides. The fleeing forces reached their base camp, in which there were still 8,000 troops. Judah decided against pursuit of Lysias' forces, which fled towards Hebron, because despite his success, he hesitated to be drawn into hostile country. Lysias, discouraged by the low fighting quality of his mercenaries, retired and withdrew to Antioch. His army had been soundly defeated with the loss of some 5,000 men. But his withdrawal without any attempt to put up a fight was due primarily to political reasons rather than military. It was obvious to Lysias that he would require a stronger army to fight with Judah. The Battle of Beth Zur had been the most serious defeat in the Seleucid army, led by the viceroy himself and enjoying considerable superiority in men and weapons. Judah estimated he had gained a breathing spell, that Seleucid prestige had waned, and that internally the empire was now very unstable and precarious. As a result, he assumed he had won the struggle for the time being. The Maccabees had achieved religious freedom for their people, and now Judah's thoughts turned to the achievement of political independence. His first step in that direction would be to go to Jerusalem, rededicate the temple, and affirm before the entire Jewish nation the attainment of religious freedom. Once again in Jerusalem, he postponed the attack on the Acra, but restored the temple area, and it says his forces contained the Seleucid garrison. The Jews entered the temple, removed all the profanations, built a new altar, and restored the interior of the temple and consecrated it. On the 25th day of Kislev in 164 B.C., the temple was rededicated. The Talmud relates the story of a miracle that followed. All they could find in the way of holy oil was one cruse, enough to last one day. So they lit the lamp in the temple, and it burned for 8 days. So today that is commemorated how? Anyone know? Yeah, Hanukkah. So it's called the Feast of Lights because it commemorates this little oil lamp, I suppose it may have been a big oil lamp, that burned for 8 days with only one day's worth of oil in it. It says this event is commemorated annually in the Jewish festival of Hanukkah. Not long after that, Judah had to send armies to the surrounding areas to destroy the Greek forces and to rescue a lot of the Judeans, the Jews who were under attack. And then about a year and a half later, there was another army sent down. But before that, Judah decided to make overtures to the Roman Senate. he decided that the best way to secure for his country some peace was to become an appendage of the Roman Empire. The embassy which he dispatched to Rome met with success and concluded a treaty of alliance between Rome and Judea. It's recorded in 1 Maccabees chapter 8. For the first time since the Babylonian exile, Judea was regarded as an independent power by none other than the major power in the world at that time. However, their reaction to this was that the king in Syria, Demetrius, sent an even larger army down to attack the rebellious Maccabees. In the spring of 160, Demetrius dispatched Bacchides at the head of a force of 20,000 infantry and 4,000 cavalry. They also had with them a lot of elephants. During this time, Judah's army had begun to disintegrate. The men went back to their farms. The urgency of the time seemed to have abated, and so he was left with only about 800 valiant men. At the head of his 800 valiant men, Judah engaged Bacchides' 20,000 troops. Of course, the battle did not go very well. Judah had concentrated his attack on the enemy's right flank, which was being led by Bacchides. His attack was successful, but he did not achieve his main purpose, which was to kill the Seleucid general. When the right flank under Bacchides broke and fled, Judah and his men followed them in hot pursuit, but the Jewish forces assigned to hold the enemy's left flank were overwhelmed, and the Seleucid left flank wheeled and pursued Judah's forces, who in turn were pursuing Bacchides. Then Bacchides turned to give battle, and Judah was sandwiched in between the forces facing him and pursuing his left flank. A bitter battle ensued with many casualties on both sides. Judah the Maccabee was among the fallen. All Israel made great lamentations for him and mourned many days and said, "How is the Mighty One fallen, the Savior of Israel?" By his self-sacrifice and example, Judah had inspired his people to continue the fight. The leadership passed on to his brothers, first Jonathan and later Simon, who after a long and bitter struggle achieved Judah's dream of independence. So we have this long period of time, and almost in the year 130 BC, when they finally agreed to have a complete independence from the Syrians. So in this report here I've got, or in the important date list, we have the Hasmonean Resolution. Now the Hasmoneans were the ones who became the ruling class of that part of the world of Judea. They reigned from about 130 to the year 64 BC, when the Roman general Pompey took Jerusalem. And of course, after that, in the year 37 BC, Herod the Great occupied the area and became its king. And that would be probably 64 BC would be the logical end of this era of the Old Testament group, because after that, it became the Pharisaical area. Now, the Hasmoneans, Hasmon, whoever he was, is named after, was the grandfather of Mattathias. So it was a long-standing family name. The high priestly and princely dignity of the Hasmoneans was found by a resolution adopted in September of 141 BC. This is after they had won independence or were very close to winning it through all their fighting for about 25 years. At a large assembly of priests, the people of the elders of the land, to the effect that Simon should be their leader. Simon was one of the brothers of Judas Maccabee. He was to be their leader and high priest forever until there should arise a faithful prophet. Recognition of the new dynasty by the Romans was accorded in the Senate in 139 BC, when the delegation of Simon was in Rome. Therefore, from an historic point of view, one can speak of the Hasmonean dynasty as beginning with Simon. When Jonathan the Maccabee fell into the power of Tryphon, Simon, his brother, assumed leadership in 142, after the murder of Jonathan took the latter's place. Simon, who had made the Jewish people entirely independent of the Syrians, reigned from 142 to 135. He was assassinated at the instigation of his son-in-law Ptolemy, but Simon was followed by his third son, John Hyrcanus. Now, John Hyrcanus, that's spelled H-Y-R-C-A-N-U-S, is very prominent in many Jewish historical books and is written about quite often in books about the background of the world into which Jesus Christ was born. His two older brothers, Matthias and Judah, had been murdered together with their father. John Hyrcanus ruled from 135 to 104 B.C., according to his directions, the government of the country after his death was to be placed in the hands of his wife, Aristobulus, and the eldest, and his wife and Aristobulus, the eldest of his five sons. Aristobulus was not satisfied with this, but cast his mother into prison and allowed her to starve to death. By this means, he came into the possession of the throne, which, however, he did not long enjoy. After a year's reign, he died to a painful illness. His successor was his eldest brother, Alexander Janius, who together with his two brothers was freed from prison by the widow of Aristobulus. Alexander reigned from 103 to 76 BC and died in the siege of the fortress of Ragabah. Alexander was followed by his wife Alexandra, who reigned from 76 to 67. Against her wishes, she was succeeded by her son, Aristobulus II, who during the illness of his mother had risen against her in order to prevent the succession of the elder son, Hyrcanus. During the reign of Alexander, Hyrcanus had held the office of high priest, and the rivalry between him and Aristobulus brought about a civil war, which ended with the forfeiture of freedom of the Jewish people. Palestine had to pay tribute to Rome and was placed under the supervision of the Roman governor of Syria. From 63 to 40, the government was in the hands of Hyrcanus II. After the capture of Hyrcanus by the Parthians, Antigonus, a son of Aristobulus, became king from 40 to 37. His Hebrew name was Mattathias, and he bore the double title of king and high priest. Herod the Great, 37 to 4, became king of the Jews, and the rule of the Hasmonean dynasty was ended. So we have the end of this era when the Romans came in 64 B.C., but it was precipitated by about 60 years of corruption, of the leadership of the church or of the group at that time fighting amongst each other, a lot of assassinations, a lot of intrigue to become the king or the leader. It just seems to happen over and over and over in human history that people are simply not able to lead other people, that they're simply not qualified to be rulers. So we have that incredible history. The history of this era, the Maccabean era of that part of the church, is one of a very small group accomplishing incredible things with very powerful leadership, with courage, with a lot of faith in God. They were doing what was right, and they were able to bring complete freedom then to that land for about 150 years. Now I want to read in the autobiography of Mr. Herbert Armstrong. The New Testament era of the Philadelphian church, or the Philadelphian era of the New Testament, really began in about the year 1928 when Mr. Armstrong was called into the ministry in Oregon. By that time, the Church of God Seventh Day had broken up in a variety of small little groups, different conferences, and the work they had been doing, small as it was, became even smaller. There was the depths of the Great Depression coming, and there simply was not an ability to do much work in the terms of any resources or people. In 1928, Mr. Armstrong was living in Portland. He began to study at the Portland Library and eventually came to the truth about the Sabbath and some other things. In chapter 29 of his autobiography, he mentions the beginnings, the meetings, or the real beginning of the present work. The meetings held by Elder S.A. Oberg and me in the Hollywood District of Salem, Oregon, ended on July 1st, 1933. Just prior to that date, I received an invitation that was to result in the start of this great worldwide work today. The invitation came from Mr. and Mrs. Elmer Fisher. They were the couple who had been brought into the church by our private Bible study in our room the night the storm prevented the meeting during the tent campaign in Eugene. The Fishers were successful farmers living 7 miles west of Eugene. Mr. Fisher was a member of the school board in the one-room Fir Butte school. The Fishers asked me to hold meetings in this country schoolhouse, invited me to be a guest in their farm home during that time. I was still in the employ of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God. The salary, as stated in the preceding chapter, was $3 per week. And we've gotten a couple raises since then, but not much. I'm just kidding. The conference was to have paid our house rent in Salem, and they supplied us with bulk foods, whole wheat flour, raw sugar, beans, etc. The farmers supplied us with vegetables and fruits. However, prior to the time, the conference was unable to pay our house rent, which was $7 a month. So they began to have these arrangements for these public Bible lectures. And, of course, took place in July in 32 here in Eugene. And before long, of course, the World Tomorrow broadcast began. He mentions here that I'd like to read this chapter, or this part to begin with. At the very start of what was to continue steadily expanding into a worldwide force directed and empowered by God, Satan tried more viciously than ever to stop this work while it was still small. Surely no activity could have started smaller. The things of God, when the eternal works through human instruments, must start at the very smallest, like the grain of mustard seed. But they grow. No power, no grouping of power, whether satanic or human, can stop or prevent God's purpose. Satan may be far more powerful than man, but God is incomparably more powerful than Satan. I suppose these opposing ministers thought they were doing right. There's always a way that seems right to man, but God says those ways are wrong and end in death. A deceived man cannot comprehend that. I don't want to impute motives. I could not read these men's in heart. But I know that, regardless of intent, their actions sought at every turn to destroy what was proved by its fruits, the very work of God. Today, far more powerful and formidable human powers are being marshaled against it. It's interesting that Mr. Armstrong was ordained an apostle on the day of Pentecost in 1931, which would have been 1900 years exactly after the original day of Pentecost when the original apostles were ordained and sent out to do their work. The 19-year cycles, I think we used to talk about them a lot more than we do have in recent times, but most of us are familiar with those. He talks about the two big milestones that were opened in 1934. The first broadcast came on in the first Sunday of 1934. He said he had mic fright. He said, arrived at the radio station, the announcer did not come in the studio until 10 or 15 seconds before 7:45. He said, "Greetings, friends." But suddenly something had happened. Before these two words were finished, something hit me like a jolt. Something had started my heart pounding. I was gasping for breath. So eventually he just calmed down and had a good broadcast and began to produce some responses. Then we have the plain truth beginning in 1934. First the broadcast in January of 1934, then the plain truth. He said here, this work, or a powerful door opens. Actually, what was happening had been written almost 1900 years earlier. God began the work of his church through Christ. Jesus said that he himself was powerless. It was the power of God's Holy Spirit working in his personal human body that really did the work. God sent his message, the good news of his kingdom, of his reign, his government, his divine family, to mankind by Jesus Christ. The message from God, Jesus Christ's gospel, was also recorded in the scriptures of the New Testament. The men rejected the gospel, they crucified Jesus by teaching it, or for teaching it. Those who preached it were persecuted or martyred. During the first 19-year time cycle, the preaching of the gospel from A.D. 31 to A.D. 50, the gospel was being preached primarily to Jews. The Jews had understood about the kingdom of God. They were familiar with the prophecies of Isaiah chapter 9, of how the Messiah would come to set up a kingdom and government of God all over the world. What the Jews did not understand was that Jesus' first coming as a babe, born of a Virgin Mary, was to qualify by resisting and conquering Satan, to replace Satan on the throne of the earth, as well as to announce the kingdom to appear 1900 years later, and also to pay with his own life's blood for the penalty of human sins. But the preaching of the apostle and the other apostles to the people of the Gentile world was the very gospel Jesus Christ had proclaimed, the good news of the future coming kingdom of God and a world rulership of Christ. Somewhere around the middle of the first century, a violent controversy had begun to develop as to whether the gospel to be preached was merely a gospel about Christ, of his messiahship and death as our Savior, or the very message God sent by Jesus as the divine messenger with the message of the true gospel, good news of the coming of the kingdom of God. He mentions here that he started a three-point campaign with going on KORE, a very small, weak station in Eugene. Went on in 1934 in January. He said the idea had come to me in 1927, a publication called The Plain Truth. Then I made an entire dummy of this proposed magazine. I'd even written articles for it. I even had a professional letter artist design the front cover idea back in 1927. Now at last, I realized this magazine was a must follow-up for the radio broadcast. Necessity is a mother invention. If we could not afford to publish a high-quality magazine, I would simply convert the bulletin, mimeographed, I have been issuing for our scattered church brethren in the Willamette Valley. My idea for this magazine from the start had been to publish it not for church members, but for the general public, and to make God's truth plain. We had to start with about 250 copies done by hand on a mimeograph. I would start it. Like a grain of mustard seed, it started very small, the smallest of magazines, but has now grown into a professional appearing magazine of over 8 million in circulation. Therefore, I wrote to the small number of members on the mailing list I had, about 50, about the coming three-point campaign, the half-hour Sunday radio program, the new mimeograph magazine for interested listeners, and personal public meetings. On the first Sunday morning of the new year, 1934, precisely at 10 a.m., we were on the air. Mr. Hill suggested that we produce a regular Sunday morning service condensed into 30 minutes. I had planned it according to his suggestion. A new local church then meeting at the Gene Schoolhouse, 12 miles west of Eugene. We had a young couple called Claude and Velma Ellis. They, of course, sang and did some of the music. At the time, I began working on the volume 1, number 1 of my magazine of my dreams. Still living with the Fishers, 7 miles west of Eugene, my wife and children still at the Hall Street House in Salem, I had to hold the mimeograph stencils up against the window and try to cut the headlines with my right hand while I tried to hold the pencil without slipping against the window pane with my left. The headlines were a little shaky. That first issue of The Plain Truth was somewhat amateurish and homemade looking. No one but myself would have called it a magazine. No publication could have had a more humble or smaller start, but it was a start. It grew and improved as scanty funds permitted. It was sometime later in 1934 that a few special offerings made it possible for us to purchase an old, outdated Neo-style. It was the predecessor to the mimeograph, entirely hand-operated. The sheets of paper had to be fed into it one at a time. There was nothing automatic about it. It cost $10. We were also able, finally, to buy a second-hand typewriter for $10. And so finally, the plain truth, homemade at Fisher's Farm on the mimeograph I was permitted to use at the office of the local mimeograph dealer, but containing priceless truth, made its humble bow on February the 1st in 1934, about 250 copies. Looking back now, we are a little amazed to see how far the broadcast and the plain truth have gone since then. That grain of mustard seed is multiplying mightily under the mighty hand of God. So he continues on about the Eugene campaigns and about the growth of the work at Eugene, the purchase of a small building, and of course then dealing with all of those individuals who were trying to stop his work, trying to stop what God was doing at that time. He mentions here, I find a letter dated September 19, 1935, sent out by three members of the Eugene Church, telling members of and co-workers of our dire need of an automobile. I had not owned a car since leaving Salem for Astoria in December 1931. For all those meetings I held 8, 12, or 15 miles west of Eugene, I had been forced to hitchhike or ride or be taken by someone attending who had a car. Here are a few excerpts from this letter. Dear friend, we want to bring to your attention a few facts that have not been known about the work, ministry, and circumstances of your radio pastor and editor, Herbert Armstrong. He started this work of the Bible evangelism without any money or income of his own. He has received no salary or income from any organization, but solely on sheer faith in the Lord to supply his needs and those of his family. To do this, Brother Armstrong and his family have sacrificed in a way you will little dream of. Most of the time, Brother Armstrong has been preaching 6 to 9 times a week. He and his wife do all the work of printing, folding, addressing, stamping, and mailing out the plain truth themselves to save expenses. We are three of the many who have been converted by his preaching during the past year. Now the work is expanding. He has urgent calls to open evangelistic meetings at once near Salem. The way is opening for him to go on the air in Portland. The Brother Armstrong is severely handicapped and may be prevented from expanding this great work because he has no car. The time has come. He must make quick trips back and forth between Portland, Salem, and Eugene. He also must have a way to get around to visit more of his radio audience, especially the sick and afflicted who call upon him for prayer. So we, the undersigned, have taken it upon ourselves as a committee of three to try to help the Lord's help and blessing to provide a car for this great purpose. We have in mind not even the lowest price new car, but a used car, the lowest price car that will serve the purpose and cover the mileage you will now have to cover. We are starting this fund as a sacrifice to ourselves. As a result of their letter, a fund of $50 was raised. We purchased a 1929 model Graham Page. I've never seen one of those. Maybe so few of them around. In Portland, the price was $85. We signed papers and paying the additional $35 with the understanding I was to have 10 days to pay it in cash and save the carrying charges of the year's contract. So there's just simply more of the beginning of the work of the Philadelphian era in the New Testament. Most of us know how large it grew. On the paper here, we have mentioned that in 1953, the radio broadcast went to Europe. In 1947, the Ambassador College was founded and began operational. Between 1954 and 1974, the church grew to almost 150,000 people worldwide and published really hundreds of millions of pieces of literature. In 1970, Mr. Armstrong began visiting world leaders. The Apostle Paul, as you recall, was told he had to go before Caesar, which he did. No one knows what happened to Caesar when he heard Paul's testimony. Caesar obviously was not baptized, did not become converted. So some have criticized Mr. Armstrong, but you know, we don't know what will be the result of his going to see Mrs. Gandhi and all the other world leaders that we knew of. I know that none of the Japanese Diet members or their representatives were ever baptized. Certainly Anwar Sadat was assassinated a few years after and was not ever baptized. So God alone understands the purpose for why that occurred and why Mr. Armstrong was able to go there and see Golda Meir and all the others. But it was similar in some, at least in principle, to the Apostle Paul going to Caesar. Finally, in 1986, Mr. Armstrong died, and within a few years, the church leadership that took over did not agree with Mr. Armstrong's teachings and the church leadership became corrupt and openly began teaching heresy. And finally, in 1994, almost exactly like all the earlier church eras, because of the corruption of the leadership and the lack of holding fast to God's truth and God's worship, and of course, that thing fell apart. I want to go over now to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. You see, the Maccabean period was very prominent in the minds of the first century New Testament people. The church to which Paul wrote, to them the Maccabean history was like our Civil War. It was that close in time. They very much admired Judas Maccabee and his brothers and how they had fought and gotten rid of the Greeks. They were hoping to do the same thing with the Romans. Part of the reason why the Romans kept killing people and they were so afraid of a revolt was because the revolt of the Maccabees had been successful in 167 to 130 B.C., and they'd thrown off the Greeks, and now, of course, many of them thought, I'll be the next Judas Maccabee, and I'll throw off the Romans. In Hebrews chapter 11, we have this Heroes of Faith chapter. Beginning in verse 32, it mentions, what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms. Now, when they read this, they probably would have thought of Judas Maccabee subduing the kingdom of the Greeks. Of course, other of God's people, down through history, have subdued kingdoms. David did, Joshua did, many others. Worked righteousness, obtained promises, and stopped the mouth of lions. Lions often represent foreign armies. A lot of empires and great armies have used the lion as their symbol. They quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword. Out of weakness were made strong. The Maccabees were a very weak, small group. The Church of God basically has always been a weak, small group in need of God's strength and help. Became valiant in battle, very true of the Maccabees. Turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Again, maybe referring to the Maccabees. Certainly many of the commentators feel that this five or six verses in here refers in several phrases to the Maccabees and their group. Women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had a trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth. Most commentaries believe that is referring only to the Maccabees, because they did live in the dens and the caves, and lived in the deserts and the mountains when they were fighting with the Syrians. These all, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. So the sixth era of the Old Testament church, the Maccabean era, was a time of great exploits, a time of incredible things being done, a time of throwing off an enemy army that was trying to enforce their own version of the mark of the beast. Now let's go over to Revelation chapter 3. We haven't even read the section, the letter to the Philadelphian church yet. The word Philadelphia means love of a brother or brotherly love. It was named after the person that found it, a man named Attalus Philadelphus. It was a town of Lydia, the region of Lydia in Asia Minor, approximately 28 miles southwest of Sardis. It was a rich agricultural area, but was also subject to frequent earthquakes. It was destroyed and rebuilt several times. It long remained a Christian city and was a Christian outpost in Asia Minor when it fell in about 1390 A.D. to the Turks. The modern-day Turkish town is called Alashir, or Alashir, meaning City of God. This church at Philadelphia was called the Church of Brotherly Love. It was apparently the church that was most favored by Jesus when he wrote there, when he said this, by Jesus Christ when he gave this to this history in advance to John. However, it's not perfect because it has among it what's called the synagogue of Satan. Verse 7 of chapter 3. To the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these things says he who was holy, he was true. So here is to the messenger or to the chief person of the church in Philadelphia, these things are coming from the one who is holy and is true, the one who has the key of David. Now, the key of David is open for a certain amount of suspect opinion. The key of David is mentioned in Isaiah chapter 22 and verse 22. As the key of the house of David, I will lay upon his, means Eliakim's, shoulder. So he shall open and none shall shut, and he shall shut and none shall open. So Eliakim was a priest, and he was able then in Isaiah 22 to be the one God would say would let people in and out of the temple of God. So that is one biblical reference. But the key of David we've also always understood as being the passing of the heritage of the throne, the right to have a son always sit on the throne of David, of Judah, and rule, the throne to which Jesus Christ is going to return. The angel announced to Mary that her son would sit upon the throne of his father David, so we know that is true. We also have understood the key of David as being the understanding of repentance, that David had a heart after God's own, and he understood in Psalm 51 and other places that he needs to completely repent and come true to God. He is true. He has the key of David. And without the real understanding of repentance, which Mr. Armstrong had, a church could not be built. Another understanding or another application of the key of David would be, you know, a valiant in battle. David was able to fight off bears and lions when he was young and they attacked his flock. In later years, he killed the great giant Goliath. He was a very fearsome fighter and very valorous in battle, a lot of courage. And of course, he based that on his faith in God. So the key of David could also include, perhaps, the fighting of Judas Maccabee, the great generalship, the incredible ability to fight and to wage war and to attack the enemy. It might also include the courage of Herbert Armstrong and being able to start a radio and a broadcasting and a publishing work when there were no resources, when there was nothing there really to work with but the meagerest small number of people. Then it says, he who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. So God is the one who opens the door and makes these things possible for people who have the key of David and those who want to do what he wants to get accomplished. Then he says, see, I know your works. God knew the works, the things they did, the battles they won, the times they stood up for the truth. God says, I know your works. I know how hard you have tried to accomplish what I wanted you to do. Therefore, see, I have set before you an open door that no one can shut. It's amazing how Judas Maccabee won his battles, one after the other, for about 3 years, against overwhelming odds, against superior forces, against better trained generals. He did it because God gave him the strength and because he was counting on the spiritual strength of his people to help him. And he had a great sense of how to form the battles and how to fight against the enemy. So he had a little strength. Certainly the army was small, starting out with less than 200 men, finally growing to about 10,000. Mr. Armstrong's work started very, very small, growing finally to almost 140,000 people. So we started with a little strength, and even in comparison to the 6 billion on the face of the earth, that was still a very small number. Have kept my word. Mattathias, Judas's father, kept his word and would not kill a pig and eat pork in front of all the Greeks and the other people there. Instead, he chose to go on the offensive. And it says, you've not denied my name. So in public, when asked about whether he was a worshiper of God, the Maccabees always said yes. They didn't deny it by saying no, by pretending to be Hellenized and worshiping the Greeks. So these things were to happen in the past and also have happened in our recent past and will continue to happen as this era continues. Some of them anyway. Indeed, I'll make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Now, who is the synagogue of Satan? Well, if it's a synagogue, it's a false form of worship. All during the time of Israel, there were those who pretended to be Jews but had a different idea of worshiping idols. In the time of Judas Maccabee, it would have been the priesthood who said they were God's priests, but indeed they were worshiping Helen, or the Greek gods like Zeus, Jupiter, and they were forcing others to do the same thing. So those who were the synagogue of Satan were a part of the group, but they really were not truly spiritual Jews. They had a different God to worship, and it says, God says, they were liars. Now, in Mr. Armstrong's experience, to begin with, way back in the 1920s and early 30s when he was starting, there were other men who came in, ministers of the Church of God, Seventh Day, and others, who said they wanted to help. And what Mr. Armstrong found is that very often they were Pentecostal in nature. They would take over a meeting before everyone along there wanted to up waving their arms and dancing around. And as you know, Pentecostalism is a result of demon influence. And periodically, during the history of the Philadelphian era, there was an effort to get things to go a little Pentecostal or a little bit crazy. There was a little movement in that direction in Ambassador College in 1971, or maybe it was the spring of 72, when Mr. Armstrong was gone during one of the student forums. They had three or four kids got up and started talking about praising Jesus or some crazy thing. I wasn't there. I heard about it. But, of course, it didn't last long. Mr. Armstrong put the old kibosh on it. But that spirit has always been there trying to stop the effort of Mr. Armstrong and what God was doing. Back in 1992, when I was at a meeting, or having a, I'm not sure if it was a meeting, but a dinner with other ministers, we were talking about what was going on with the takeover of the leadership of the church. I observed that, well, and I think a couple others, Mr. Smith was there and some others, that probably the very same demons who tried to stop Mr. Armstrong back in the 20s were now possessing people in Pasadena who were trying to stop and destroy what he had done then. And we predicted that eventually the entire thing would go Pentecostal, because that's the effort, we felt, where the effort was being made. And certainly much of the literature being sent out to the church members was theologically the basis of modern-day Pentecostal movements. So I think it's just an observation, I'll put it in those terms, that this past week they announced that the auditorium that Mr. Armstrong felt was at least a reflection of God's temple that has been sold to a Pentecostal group, and one of their first big speakers is going to be the most famous Pentecostal in the world. Anyone know his name? Yeah, Benny Hinn. I mean, he just, all kinds of healings, he says. It's just, I've not been there, obviously, but I've talked to people who have been there, and they said that his meetings are wild, just off the edge wild. So this Pentecostal group will eventually now take over this building, and who knows, it may be the same spirits, we can't see spirits, that were at work back in the 20s and 30s. You know, demons can't hurt you, they can torment you, and they can torment and cause all kinds of problems. And so it may be the same group at work who now will sort of celebrate by having their meeting in what Mr. Armstrong dedicated as a temple to the great God. So there are synagogue of Satan elements among us. There always have been. And to say that the Philadelphian era wouldn't have those would be wrong, because they were there the entire time that Judas Maccabee was fighting the enemy. And they, of course, have been subdued when there were stronger elements spiritually. But there's always a danger. He says, "Indeed, I'll make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you." So someday all of those who were trying to say, well, you know, you were wrong, trying to get all these other movements in there, someday God will bring them before the feet of those who held fast, and they will know where the real truth was. "Because you have kept my command to persevere," and indeed Judas Maccabee and all of his army and his brothers were examples of that. It took them from 167 until, actually 166 until 130 B.C., 35 years to finally defeat the Romans, or I'm sorry, the Greeks, and to establish their independence, which lasted only for about 80 years. "But because you've kept my command to persevere, I will also keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell upon the earth." It's already been fulfilled with Mr. Armstrong. He's in the grave. And there are thousands of others who are in the grave waiting for the time of the resurrection. They have been spared the hour of trial coming upon the earth. But there also is the implication that there will be some alive from this group who will be spared at that time, the time of the testing of those who dwell upon the earth. So there is an element of this era still left, apparently. "Behold, I am coming quickly. When the Philadelphia era is over, it will not be much longer before Jesus Christ returns. Hold fast what you have, that no man take your crown." We are in a time when there are a lot of men, a lot of false teachers with every sort of heresy and crazy idea out there trying to take our crown. "He who overcomes, I'll make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more." So these people would go into the temple and become part of the center structure or the most exalted positions in the temple of God. "I'll write on him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes then out of heaven from my God." And then to say it a second time, just for complete affirmation, "I will write on him my new name." So we have this new name being wrote upon us. The words in reference to God the Father, where Jesus said, my God, so many times, or prayed to his Father in heaven. So we have here this admonition to hold fast. And if we do, we will hold, become part of the pillar in the temple of God. Says, I will write on him my name and will not go out. We don't know if what's happened in recent times is a type of the abomination of desolation. That really occurred in 167 when the pig was put in there, and this forced religion was then enjoined upon all the people of Jerusalem and the surrounding area. But we know it's something that's very important for us to understand, because it is going to happen again in the future. And if we're going to be truly part of the Philadelphian era, then we have to do what it says here, to hold fast, that no man take our crown, and wait for the day when God himself will give us his name.